The withdrawal of Rome from Britain in the 4th century wasn't quick. The slow decline created an environment in which small kingdoms and communities emerged as independent or semi-independent states. Today, we're going to explore those lost kingdoms of Great Britain.
Hello, my name is Gareth Edwards, and welcome to the Untitled History Podcast. Join me each week alongside world-leading experts as we take a deep dive into your favorite topics from throughout history. From the ancient world to the modern, and with plenty of historical rabbit holes in between, we'll cover famous and not-so-famous moments in history from all across the globe.
The rise of the United Kingdom as a single entity was never inevitable. Even the period of the Heptarchy, the seven kingdoms of East Anglia, Essex, Kent, Mercia, Northumbria, Sussex, and Wessex, was far less centralized than most people think. For centuries after the official departure of Rome, the British Isles were a network of small kingdoms, sometimes subservient to larger ones. Many of these are lost entirely to time. Some we can only realize today through fragments of literature, archaeology, or place names. All of this makes this a fascinating period of history, and one we're going to explore a bit through looking at a few of those kingdoms today. And joining me to do that is Alex Harvey. Say hello, Alex.
Hi there.
So, for those unfamiliar with Alex, Alex is a historian and archaeologist, and he's the author of multiple history books on the early medieval period, one of which is behind me there, and one of which I have digitally. And these books include The Forgotten Vikings, and the one that's very relevant today and why I wanted to have you on, which is your most recent book, The Little Kingdoms, which is an A to Z history of early medieval Britain. So thanks very much for coming on, Alex. It's a fascinating period, this, isn't it? This post-Rome period.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. It's a real pleasure to talk about this era. I think it, in some ways, more than the Vikings, because while the Viking Age was my first foray into history and a period I very much love, there's something slightly more enchanting, I think, about the era just beforehand, because not only does it set the scene for the Lindisfarne raid in a way people don't always appreciate, but it's also this quite haunting and enchanting coda to the even better known Roman era. So it's like the awkward middle triangle between them both. And there's many reasons for that, of course. Lack of appeal in pop culture, other than King Arthur and Beowulf. And also, it's the evidence from the era is so confusing, it's quite difficult to grapple with.
And I think also, there's this perception that the departure of Rome is a sort of sudden event, you know, that suddenly the emperor rocks up and says, right, you're on your own, lads, I'm taking the army away, and everyone jumps on ships and they leave. And that's just an absolutely false perception of how this period plays out, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the thing is, much of these tropes come from, originally, I suppose, genuine late Roman parables and narrative tropes. Just speaking from like the 4th, 5th, 6th century onwards. But where they became really cemented was with a man called Sir Edward Gibbon in the 18th century, who wrote this most magisterial work. It's huge. I mean, it is impressive, but it contains, even in the title itself, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Very similarly vivid images. And I think, especially since World War II, a lot of people just place the Dunkirk imagery on the end of Roman Britain. So it's like the Operation Dynamo in reverse. Whereas instead of British troops coming back to Britain from France, it's Roman legionaries queuing up to get into timber versions of the kind of amphibious landing craft, and then in reverse. But not so. Indeed, just to extrapolate on that a little bit, that the famous source that talks about the Britons must look to their own defences is describing a command allegedly given by Western Emperor Honorius in the year 410. And there's numerous ways of interpreting this quote. For one, it's actually first written down about 100 years after it was allegedly said, by a pagan historian called Zosimus, who wrote A New History. That's the full reference for the source. And he may have said the Britons need to look to their own defences. He may have been talking about Bruttia, which is in Italy, which completely reframes the quote. or he may have said something more like, I delegate authority of the Saxon shore to Britain. There are numerous ways of translating it, and then numerous ways of interpreting that translation. It's a bit like the late Roman taxation system. It's not a simple case of you just read the primary source and go from there. It's numerous minutiae. And in any case, whichever way you read this original source then flavors your entire view on the post-Roman period, not just in Britain, but also abroad.
And I mean, you touch on taxation there, and I think that's a really good example, because in a similar way to like the military presence just doesn't disappear and the people don't disappear overnight. Actually, for the vast majority of people living in the British Isles at the time, it's not a centralized state in the same way as we think of those things today. Even under the Romans, it's much more decentralized, and you might actually go your entire life not really having a lot of interactions with the state. How does that change or stay the same as we enter this post-Roman period, as we enter into this the sort of the late 4th, the 5th centuries and beyond, as we head towards the Vikings?
Mm. Well, I mean, that's a really good point, just for all listeners, I suppose, to remember. If they had an impression of Roman Britain as being quite bureaucratic, centralized, and really easily governable, it's not necessarily wrong to have that opinion. But I think just the bare logistics of, you know, this is an age long before, quite obviously, social media, the Industrial Revolution. So even simple things like sending messages across and sorting out regular payments, tributes, and so on, it's quite a multi-headed beast to wrangle with. So, for example, if you were in Canterbury between, let's say, 350 and 450, there would be a noticeable change. So it's not as if the decline of Rome wasn't noticed, but it just, that transition would have been very different from Kent, for example, to someone in the middle of the Yorkshire Dales. I can't imagine them giving a rat's ass, frankly, whether or not the Roman infrastructure remained, because ultimately, I suppose the archaeological evidence and metal detected goods from the Yorkshire Dales would suggest it's still a transhumance economy before, during, and after the Roman period. Nothing much changes in that regard. So if a farmer has to pay tax to a Northumbrian instead of a Roman itinerant, who cares? Yeah, whatever, take it. That's what I assume, anyway, based on numerous strands of evidence.
And let's talk a bit about the evidence that we're looking at for this period, because, again, I find this fascinating, because, listeners, we all live in a world now where evidence is everywhere, where we have sources everywhere, we have the daily life, we leave evidence of everything constantly. And the period we're talking about here, it's much harder to build up a picture of what's really happening, because the literary sources are sparse. The archaeology, we're dependent on the archaeology, but that's not always necessarily presenting a complete view. We're almost always looking at this period, aren't we, through shards, through different aspects to get to what's actually happening. And maybe they're best summarized, and maybe I'm missing something, you can tell me if I'm missing something, but we're almost looking at things like place names, the archaeology, and the literary sources that we do have, and trying to work out from those three in various balances what was really happening on the ground.
Yeah, and it is very much a case of wrestling with at least three, sometimes more, disciplines and also sub-strands between them. For example, archaeology technically encompasses the study of coins, numismatics, but a numismatist, a specialist in that area, has a very different skill set to, say, a field archaeologist. And everyone will have a preferred discipline. There are very few people in the world who are immensely skilled across all three of the major disciplines. Massive respect to those people. But I came into studying this era through the archaeology. So for me, it's always been the stories that physical objects can tell us. The reason I find archaeology so engrossing is because, more so than the kind of vast sweeping narratives of chronicles, it's everyday life. It's the kind of loom weight someone leaves behind on a rainy Monday. It's the lump of iron ore that was left in a doorway as part of the closing ceremony of a farmstead. It's a piece of lead inscribed with, "Can you stop this dwarf from giving me a headache, please?" from Norfolk. That's a genuine lead sheet I've just mentioned there. And I think that the kind of everyday episodes like that is a really productive way of looking into any historical era. I suppose the caveat there is you can't really meaningfully construct a grand historical narrative just using objects, because it's scattered and it's fragmented. Whereas something like just textual histories is fascinating in a whole other way, because then you've got to deal with authorial bias. You've got to deal with the provenance, the time in which that source is made, what it's saying that the archaeology doesn't support, vice versa. And both of those disciplines, archaeology and history, I think are very accessible. Archaeology, perhaps slightly less so. But like you said, most sources nowadays are digitized. Now, I know we had a little chat before we started recording, and I'll just get one off my shelf, for example. I'd always recommend physical copies of primary sources, ideally multiple if you can get them, like different translations. But you can access translated versions, digitized versions of historical texts really easily nowadays. So it means that reading the text on a surface level is something readily available. But you need to obviously build up a wider context to interpret the eras in which these sources were written and what authors are and are not saying. Now, that the final, strand of learning that you mentioned there, which is linguistics. Now, this to me is still quite arcane. And it's a skill I try to develop, probably much less successfully than the other two. And the study of the names, onomastics, etymology, linguistics, place name studies. I say in Little Kingdoms itself that much of the references to these strands of evidence come from the great work of the Society for Name Studies in Britain and Ireland. I've got several colleagues who are absolutely wizards when they come to linguistics, possessing skills that I just cannot match. But that's a great thing about interdisciplinary research, is you make these connections. And I don't think any book, be it academic or more commercial in nature, can be written alone. You have to kind of lean on colleagues and so on, offer advice and get advice, listen. So I mean, the whole study of early medieval Britain is one that requires plurality and working together.
And that effectively then starts to build up a tiny fragment, it is only ever really a tiny fragment, of a vision of what it might have been like in that post-Roman period and in those little kingdoms almost that are popping up. And I think one thing I find fascinating about this, particularly when you look at things like names and the study of names, is one, we all see those names around us at all times. They're the names of towns, they're the names of places we live, they're the names of the hills that we walk over. You know, I was a scout, and like I think back to like looking at those maps and going over all those things in Hertfordshire when I was growing up, and seeing all these names of hills and forests and woods or farms that no longer exist or farms that do exist. But the farmer has no idea why his farm is called these things.
Yeah.
And I find that fascinating, that this is a world, those ripples of that world still exist now in various ways. And we'll talk a bit, I think, about, in a particular instance, there's a really good example of that that you pick up in later on when we look at some of the specific places. But before we do that, I do also want us to maybe touch on another bit of a myth that seems to exist around this area, which is that it's one of sort of waves of immigration, that it's almost it's single direction travel. People are coming to the UK, to the British Isles from abroad, they're settling and then they're not going back, and that they replace the people that are already there. And both of those things are wrong, really, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the kind of tried and tested invasion of small boats narrative that has been applied to a number of historical periods. But when you consult the linguistic archaeological evidence, for example, if we stick with maritime terminology, it's less of a sudden flood or a flash wave, rather a constant, mundane, very boring trickle in all directions, like an omnidirectional swirl with the North Sea at the centre and places like the Netherlands, Jutland in Denmark, then the east coast of England, all receiving immigrants and also bearing emigres over the waves to other locations. And don't get me wrong, there are instances across the 4th, 5th, 6th, and so on, centuries, where it's referenced as a particularly notably large group of people moving. And I'm not saying these episodes don't occur. DNA evidence, for example, and isotopic studies, even really recent papers, do support a few instances of, you know, large-scale migration. But it's amidst a milieu of constant movement. So it's not as if people are just living in mud huts, throwing bricks at one another when the Romans leave, and they're completely confused when, you know, Mr. Hengist and Mr. Horsa show up in Kent. Who are you? What? Barbarians. It's not that case at all. In fact, they would have been united, not only in the sense of there being kind of multiple North Sea languages being spoken at any one time, but also in the common factor of Rome as a kind of cultural memory. Even not really a memory to some, I suppose, it would have still been implicit in their structures and hierarchies. So that goes for people we might traditionally call the Britons, and then also their Anglo-Saxon nemesis. The common factor between them both was Rome, the visual language of Rome, how they styled themselves, how they saw power conceptualized in the landscape, along roads, in their costume, even to some extent speaking Latin. So we can't really view this era as lots of different islands of disconnected communities that hate one another and are kind of born into the world with a nemesis in mind. That's to some degree painted by centuries of propaganda and also primary sources that we perhaps just read at surface level and then don't go on to inspect them deeper. So I'm going to get another book off my shelf, actually. This is Guy Halsall's Worlds of Arthur. And it's one of a number of books that I've read over the years that have reshaped my initial opinion on the Dark Ages from when I was a teenager, when I suppose did and did not learn about it at school. And for example, it's books like these and interdisciplinary works that allow us to reapproach sources like Bede, like Gildas, and the Nennian compiler from Wales, and realize that they might not actually just be writing matter-of-fact histories. Rather, they're writing narrative parables with, for example, a cyclical story in mind, where the end is just invented already and then they weave events to meet a certain point. If you look, for example, at Gregory's History of the Franks, Gregory of Tours, it's a continental source. But you read it and you think, oh, this is actually a good read. It's 10 books. Each one ends on a major moment in history. And there's cliffhangers, there's circular narratives. It's good storytelling. But that's not how history works. History is messy. People's lives are messy. We don't have story arcs. We're real people. So when you read narrative histories like this, especially of this era, you always have to remember that. There's a reason why events have been mentioned in a certain order. There's a reason the Saxons fight 12 battles against Arthur. You know, why that number, for example? So there's all manner of questions and quirks that once you start to peel them away, it completely changes the way in which you interpret the post-Roman era.
Yeah, one of my older lecturers back at uni used to say that think of books and things like Bede and Gregory and that in the same way, to a certain degree, that you get now, where we have TV documentaries that do the here's a historical reconstruction.
Yeah.
No, they are built with a narrative. They're built with an arc. Are they telling you a true story? If it's a documentary, a docudrama, yes, it is. But it's going to be framing it in a certain way. It's built for narrative. It's built for flow. And that in itself, by definition, has to lose some of the reality. It has to it controls events. It dictates how you see things. So we've talked a bit about almost the wider era. So we've got this era that it's not a massive sudden withdrawal of Rome. There's a cultural transition. There's a societal transition, but it is to a certain extent gradual. We've talked about the fact that it's not just about waves of immigration. We have this flow of people across and between places. Maybe we should look at some of the specific places like that we picked. We picked a few that you cover in the book, but I like that you like. And maybe we should use them as a way of giving listeners a sort of try and give them some kind of feel for what they'd be, what it was like in that period.
Yeah.
So maybe if we can kick off, we'll do one of my favorite ones, which is Lindsay, which I'm not going to describe as Yorkshire, because I will get lynched for describing it as Yorkshire. But think sort of Humber and the Wash, centered maybe on modern Lincoln, and the maybe in that is important as much as anything. It's to show that we really don't necessarily know a lot about these places. But it's a sort of a community built in that area, that sort of bottom end of Yorkshire, Lincolnshire area. Have I maybe captured that right? About halfway up the UK, if you're an American and you're not sure what we're talking about, and on the East Coast.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the broad strokes, Lindsay, especially if we're talking about migration, is a brilliant example. And just before I get into Lindsay specifically, I think this is a really productive way of framing discussions about the early medieval period, is you find an example that can best address a theme, let's say migration. You find Lindsay and you go, okay, this is a brilliant way of looking at migration. And that's essentially how I wrote the book. So there's lots of things about the early medieval period I wanted to talk about. But stringing them together in a grand narrative is, it can kind of lead you down certain paths. And I wanted to instead view all of these post-Roman successor polities in their own way, as they would, which is why the book is so anthology-like in its approach. It's 62 chapters. Some are tiny, some are quite large. And each kingdom tells its own story. And Lindsay's story is very much one of islands and the North Sea and people and language from the Netherlands, but also from further west in England and the Fens, intermingling on this rocky outcrop centred on Lincoln, the city, which has a very prominent hill, and also a few offshore islands. So Lindsay itself may have been an island attached to the British Isles as a landmass, because we can't view the modern coastline and simply take it back in time. The coastline has changed significantly. Rivers have shrunk. Industrial drainage efforts in the 1620s have sapped the fens and the marshes and the bogs of their character. And they've turned Lincolnshire from this quite isolated, weird liminal space to a slightly less weird liminal space that's now inhabited by farmers rather than fishermen and Frisians. And Lindsay, for me, is one of the premier kingdoms. It's one of my favourites. It eats up quite a lot of Bede's word count, for example. So even though he's normally associated with Northumbria, he spends an awful lot of time moaning about Lindsay. I think it appears, you know, like just under 100 times across his multiple books. And the reason for this is because Lindsay's quite awkwardly in the middle of Mercia and Northumbria. And those are two big names. People have heard of Mercia and Northumbria. Lindsay, however, is slightly more obscure. It's not the most obscure kingdom in the book, of course. There are some absolute Z-listers. But it is fairly niche. And what makes Lindsay so fascinating, I think, being in the middle of those two kingdoms, and also on the edge of the North Sea, is the amount of cultural influences that swept over the landscape and swept over the population who lived there. So we're talking certainly a Frisian presence, and the Frisians are the early medieval inhabitants of the Low Countries, especially around modern Friesland, and near, I suppose, to Amsterdam, the tourist town. But you've also got old Welsh linguistic influence, which, if we're going to simplify them, you'd call the Britons, and then people we might call the Anglo-Saxons, although they wouldn't necessarily have seen themselves in that way. And the identity that united them all may have been something like Lindsay men, or the people of Linwis, or Lindisi, because the language seems to flip between a Brittonic core around Lincoln in the 4th, 5th and 6th centuries, and then it's subsumed or eaten by an old English prestige model of language. And much of this work has been done by the fantastic scholar Caitlin Green, who has written a book even bigger than mine, just on Lincolnshire, which goes to show the level of scholarship on each of these places that, that someone like me, I suppose, distills into a very slim amount for ease of access and to inspire further reading and scholarship. So Lindsay, for me, is a microcosm of early medieval Britain, because it's at once diverse, it's complained about by foreign authors, and it's very wet and muddy, which summarizes the entire island, if you ask me.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I like about particularly you cover this in the book really well, is just also we have so many good burial artifacts from there that it gives us a really genuine picture of that flow of goods, like you say. So when you're looking at like cemetery digs where you find work, there's people find worked ivory, you know, and that just shows the level of trade and the level of flow of goods. We don't know how that got there necessarily. We don't know the route that took to get there, but we can at least see that there must have been a route for that to get there. So I find all of that fascinating, particularly as you say with Lindsay, because it's clearly almost a sort of post-Roman area that stays relatively centralized in the Roman context, which isn't necessarily true of other areas. And as you say, like in the book, you do quite a good job of using different things, different examples of these. And it sort of leads us nicely almost onto the next one, which is, I've always found this fascinating. I've always found this fascinating as an area, but which is Craven. Craven is always really interesting to me. First mentioned in the Domesday Book in 1086, and that in itself is fascinating. We've got this whole area of what is effectively an early medieval kingdom or an early medieval area that we first really truly encounter in textual terms in 1086. But maybe if you could give listeners a bit of a background on what Craven is or what we do know about it and why it's sort of different from Lindsay.
Yeah, so it's a great kind of pairing, those two. It's like a good wine and a nice cheese.
Well, good mutton almost in the case of case of Craven.
Yeah, a bit of mead, nice.
Yeah.
So where Lindsay, and you quite rightly highlighted the African ivory trade, where Lindsay's plugged in, being on the edge of the North Sea, Craven is closer to the Irish Sea coast. So if you're not familiar with the geography of Britain, Craven maps onto what's nowadays called the Yorkshire Dales, but according to Domesday Book, also Lancashire, Westmoreland, Cumbria, parts of the Lake District, and towards Morecambe Bay, and like I said, into the Irish Sea. So it's an absolutely massive area. 125 villages in Domesday Book, which of course was drawn up by William the Conqueror, or William the Bastard, as I call him. And these villages are written as insert village name in Craven. So when you map them all together, it's a huge space. And yet nowhere, in kind of contrast to Lindsay, is Craven mentioned in the entire early medieval period. Bede doesn't mention it. No saints' lives talk about Craven. The word's not used anywhere. It doesn't appear in any poems, not the old Welsh poems that are always lamenting about the loss of kingdoms. Nor does it appear in any heroic Old English poems like Beowulf or Widsith. Nowhere. So what on earth is it? Like, how do we even know that this was a kingdom? It comes down to a few factors. Now, one of them is the thoroughly unique geography of the Yorkshire Dales. Now, if you are ever in England and you drive north beyond York, for example, and you head in a northwesterly direction, the A roads will become B roads quite quickly. The B roads will then become C roads and dirt tracks, and you'll find people speeding past you towards Boroughbridge and Knaresborough. And beyond them, you enter the pearly gates of the Yorkshire Dales through towns like Harrogate, and beyond that, more importantly, Skipton. And the Yorkshire Dales is nowadays a lovely realm to hike in. It's brilliant, and it's a fairly unblemished natural landscape, save for some fairly recent industrial mining in the Victorian period. And because it's a national park, archaeological excavations have been very, very limited and sparse, which means that you can hike, for example, between the mountains of Ingleborough and Wernside and walk past 9th century farmsteads and you walk over them in some cases. They're just lumps in the ground, but you can clearly see the outlines. If you didn't know they were there, however, no clue. It just looks like a dry stone wall, of which there are plenty in the Yorkshire Dales. So if it's not mentioned anywhere and there aren't really any notable excavations, what can we even say about Craven? Well, this, I suppose, is a poster child for the whole book, in the sense that you can only really talk about Craven in snapshot form, much like you can only really get a whole picture of early medieval England by looking at all the different corners in their own way. And Craven, to me, if I was to best summarise, whatever the name means, it may mean something like land of garlic or land of scraped stones. Each one would accurately describe the unique flora and topography of the Yorkshire Dales. But it seems like the residents live a mostly unbothered life, as they do now, I suppose. Unlike Lindsay, they're not plugged in to international trade networks to the same extent. They're not constantly fought over by Northumbria and Mercia. They're just doing their own thing, probably leading lives that would have been very similar in the Iron Age, in the Roman period, in the post-Roman period, and then in the Viking Age. Farming, livestock mainly, cattle ranchers, if you like, and individual dales, which means valley, across the Yorkshire Dales, may have themselves been home to petty rural administrative districts, or maybe not. I recently published a paper on Craven, kind of summarising all of the data that we have into just a couple pages to serve as an introduction. It's behind me on the shelf there in that thin tome. And that's available open access for free online if you just type in towards.
We'll stick that in the show notes because I've not read that yet and I'm fascinated with Craven. So.
Excellent. Yeah, there we go. Beautiful. And Craven, I think, if you ask people in the Yorkshire Dales, especially around Skipton area, you know, what's Craven to you? It genuinely is still a local identity. It's on everywhere from wheelie bins to the names of museums. And I find that fascinating in its own way, that across 1,000 years of history, Craven has stuck. We don't even know what it was. It's one of my favourite little kingdoms from the whole book.
What I love about it is just, like, so archaeologically we have and you cover this in the book, that just we find things in caves. We do find some archaeological evidence that proves that something is going on there. But like you say, it highlights that the continuity of existence throughout these periods, if you're in that kind of area, if you're not strategically important, if you're sheep farmers, you're cattle farmers, you're all these things, life can just go on. You know, you maybe an army marches through very occasionally. Maybe someone turns up and says, by the way, I'm in charge now. And you go, well, yeah, but okay, you're the new guy in charge.
Yeah, you just go, you get the title, okay, whatever. Yeah, right, whatever. Fine, sure.
You know, and that continues, but that it still has that ripple that we still feel today, that it's still there. That, like you say, the word is still there and it still is on things.
Yeah.
And I find that fascinating. I mean, almost the opposite of that is what we'll talk about next, which is in terms of the being in the middle of everything, quite literally in terms of their naming, is maybe we should talk a bit about, and we can deal with these sort of together. Let's talk about the Middle Angles and the Middle Saxons. So do you want to maybe give us some geographic context for both of these groups, for the Middle Angles and the Middle Saxons?
Yeah, so the Middle Angles, these are two separate polities, I suppose, but in the book I group them together because I think they work well as a duo. But the Middle Angles, for those of you looking at a modern map, roughly maps onto like Huntingdonshire, parts of Cambridgeshire, away from the fens further inland in a kind of belt fashion. And the Middle Saxons, perhaps obviously maps onto today's Middlesex, but it's not a one-to-one alignment. And finding a core, if there even was one, of the Middle Saxons, it's difficult to say, really. North of the Thames might be the best guess, but
there's almost a temptation to assume it centres on London, and then that's to forget that London, as we know London, is not what London was back then.
Oh, exactly.
But I mean, I look, as a graduate of St Mary's in Twickenham, I'm choosing to decide that it was focused entirely on Twickenham.
Yeah, well, Twickenham. With that in mind, I mean, this is the kind of slice of life fun I love from this period. So Twickenham is just mentioned offhand in a charter from, I think, 704. And it just says a most famous place, Twickenham. And then doesn't explain why. And I love that. We have history today. And, you know, me, when I was a kid, my mum and dad took me to lots of castles and historical sites. Don't get me wrong, very grateful for that experience. But when I was a teenager, some of these famous sites were just a field. And I'd be like, oh, so boring, nothing ever happened here. There's apparently a Roman marching camp near Malham that I remember my dad took me to. We walked like an extra 30 minutes. Nothing there. Absolutely nothing. I was like, this doesn't count. This isn't history. But it is, of course. And these cultural memories linger. And what is now a field could have one day been a most famous place. And just like we have history, people in the 8th century, when that charter was written, they had history. And they had folklore and memories and maybe nightmares about certain places that have been passed down through the eons. And they may not even explain them. So Twickenham, they're like, yeah, the most famous place, Twickenham. And clearly people just knew it was famous, so they don't ask. Like, oh yeah, Twickenham, cool.
Yeah, it's the famous place.
Yeah.
We did an episode on Ship's Cats, which is an area I've done a fair bit of study in as a maritime historian. And it's infuriating trying to study Ship's Cats because they're so common that no one talks about them. They don't appear in the literary record. They don't really appear in the logs. Because of course there's a ship's cat. Like, everyone knows what the ship's cat does. Everyone knows how the ship's cat is taken care of.
They eat the everyone ship's knows. Mice.
Yeah, like why would you write about this stuff? Everyone knows it.
Yeah.
And like you say, this period has that. We have those waves of knowledge almost here. We get that with Bede. We get that with everyone. Where people are always writing from an assumption that everyone sort of has the same common frame of reference. And this is a period that I find it so like my first real encounter with this kind of thing as a teenager was reading Mary Stuart's Arthur books, her Merlin books, Merlin the Crystal Cave and all of that. And she sets that whole thing almost in this post-Roman period where you've got these things. And actually your book actually reminds me a lot in terms of how it approaches that thing and capturing that there is a certain mystery to this. And it's not mystery because there's any kind of woo-woo magic going on. It's just mystery because these things are unknowable. Because what was common then just is so out of our frame of reference that we will never understand that fully. And I do think that's one of the really amazing things about this period is it's both familiar and unknowable to us.
Yeah, and I think that can be in equal parts enticing and also quite disturbing. Like, certainly when I've been reading manuscripts and so on from not even just England, but further afield, like Germany and so on, some of the things they say is like, it's a bit dark, a bit weird, especially the religiously coded text. But then they can be hilarious without meaning to. So, I'd stress to listeners, if you don't yet possess a bookshelf full of primary sources and translations, like we do, certainly just go to a local library and see if they've got any spare copies. You can buy these for like £2 sometimes. A choice example from Gregory of Tours' History of the Franks. I can't remember the names of the figures in this episode, but there's one moment where I think a priest is moral-wise is flitting between virtuous and something else. And so a saint reminds him, you know, you can't do this. And then there's just a line where it says, and then the saint punched him in the throat. It's so funny.
That's a saintly intervention.
Yeah, just divine punishment of a man just throttling you while you're asleep and you wake up with bruises.
Throat punched by a saint.
Yeah, that's just incredible that was written. And that may not have been funny to the audience at the time. They may have read that and gone, yes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, everyone knows saints are throat punchers.
Yeah, that's Saint Nicetius. He just does that.
Yeah, yeah.
But to us today, it's like, oh man, that's hilarious. And with the Middle Angles and Middle Saxons, it's because it's kind of in the middle of them, obviously. It's a realm where religious figures congregate quite commonly in order to convert people who are not really on the map. They're kind of in the middle of areas of influence and therefore not really on anyone's radar. But of course, to be in the middle and to be on the limits of two places means you're central. It's the case for the Netherlands in the early medieval period, as argued by Nelleke Ischenager, and also the case in certain areas in England, certainly around the Middle Saxons and Middle Angles. You know, they're probably not going to make anyone's top 10 favourite kingdom list, but they're an honourable mention, certainly.
And I find, like, even the name is one of those things that doesn't quite do them justice, because ultimately, to be called the middle, you're almost defined by the things that are around you.
Yeah.
And so I've always somewhat doubted that they were running around calling themselves the Middle Saxons, or certainly not at the beginning of this period.
Fantastic.
You know, what did they call themselves? We might never know, you know.
Well, I mean, in that case, so while there is a chapter in my book about the Middle and Middle Saxons and the Middle Angles, the framing device there is all about that sense of directionality in names. But there are actually several other chapters that deal with specific kingdoms that we know had names within the greater territory of Middle Anglia, for example. So one of them is where Tolkien came from and probably inspired much of Lord of the Rings. So I won't give away too much about that, because that was quite a fun chapter to write. But I suppose overall, I mean, these groups, yeah, how they saw themselves in many ways will be forever unknowable to us. So to complete all four cardinal directions of the compass, everyone's heard of the West Saxons, Alfred the Great, whatever. East Saxons, yeah, Kingdom of Essex, Battle of Blackwater Estuary in 991, quite a premier moment. Then there's the South Saxons, the pagans of St. Wilfrid. But there's no North Saxons. And for a long time, I thought, I guess they forgot. Until I read the Annals of Ulster, and in one line, they just reference a place called North Saxon Land. And it's actually describing the far north regions of Northumbria, around modern Bamborough, so near Lindisfarne. But I just love that to the Irish and the writers of the Annals of Ulster, they just think of it as North Saxon Land. They're like, yeah, they're whatever. They're in the north. They're Saxons. Yeah, who cares?
Oh, look, as a eternal Londoner, that's now exactly how I'm going to describe everything north of Watford. I'm like, yeah, that's just North Saxon land up there. That's all it is. Well, I think certainly, hopefully, listeners, what you've come away with on this regular part of the podcast is just an idea of why I think both Alex and I love this period so much, because of it, that both the known and the unknown, that merging of the two worlds, that mystery, that level of knowledge that we might never know, but also the knowledge that we're always still discussing. There's always the chance that something gets found and it gives us that greater insight into one of these smaller kingdoms that we just don't talk about. And suddenly we discover it's a bigger part of the picture of the British Isles than we ever realized. And just again, remember, as you're looking at your street names, that you're looking at your place names, as you're encountering family names and going out for a walk, remember that all of that is in so many ways a ripple of this era. You know, it's this era talking to us today through almost that geography, that it's almost a psychohistory of places almost. But Alex, before we go, we should absolutely talk a bit about, we've kind of talked broadly in and around the books, because obviously this is part of the book, but talk a bit more about why you framed it what way, and maybe why people should pick it up.
Yeah, thank you. For me, writing any book, you have to write for yourself. And certainly with every book I've written so far and ones I'm still writing that are still to come, I've written them because I couldn't find a book like that to buy. So I thought, okay, well, I'll do it myself. Yeah, I suppose to quote Thanos, famous pop culture meme from about 10 years ago. I read an awful lot. I mainly read academic books from several libraries that I have memberships with, which is a weird flex, but go with me. And I'm also constantly reading more commercially aimed history books. And at all times, as any good writer should, you're soaking up inspiration and you're thinking, what has been written that's fantastic that I could draw some I could learn from?
and what has not been written that could do with an eye shone on it or some light shone on it. And the obscure territories of early medieval England is one of those topics. So in 2022, one of my favourite authors, and he was generous enough to provide a review for Forgotten Vikings, Thomas Williams, wrote a book called Lost Realms. And that covered nine obscure early medieval kingdoms. It's a fantastic book. Brilliant work.
If you're watching the video of this version, listeners, you might even be able to spot it on the shelf behind me somewhere, because I think it might actually be in camera frame somewhere at the moment.
It's on my shelf behind me somewhere as well.
It's on both our shelves. I mean, video watchers, you might actually be able to play spot it on both Alex and my shelves.
And that's a marvellous book. And I remember reading it, and as all good books should, it not only invigorated me in the sense of it's just nice to read a good book, isn't it? It's like a meal. But also I walked away thinking, wow, this is just the beginning. Like there must be so many more obscure niche D-listers of the early medieval period. And so I was actually in the process of writing a book on just the Yorkshire Dales. And it kind of grew from there. And I started to read monographs and excavation reports and then start to direct mine and my wife's holidays to specific areas in the UK that I knew had archaeological literature and sites worth looking at. And sooner or later, I had this catalogue of places. And I was thinking, oh, what's the best way of structuring them? And the A to Z format is what I settled on. So it was written with that in mind. So each chapter kind of piles on complexity as the book goes on, which I suppose ends up with, by the time you get to the letters E, G, H, so on, you're very well equipped to deal with any kingdom, and you know fully the terms I'm describing. So the first few chapters kind of onboard the reader and assumes some knowledge that the Dark Ages is a concept between Romans and Vikings, but that's more or less it, and then it goes from there. By the end of the book, it's probably quite complex. But equally, I think if you're a reader who is quite familiar with the early medieval period and wants a book to go into the really niche giblets that float around this soup, then you can read the book in any order you like. And my hope is that if not learning something new that I've written, you find in the reference list a really obscure source or appraisal that you've not read before, and then that inspires you to go and read that. I mean, that's all writing and reading is for me. It's just transmission of cultural capital and knowledge, and I take that quite seriously as a pursuit. I mean, I love it. That's why I teach as well as writing. So I wrote the book for me, and the fact lots of other people like it is a joyous thing. It makes me very happy. And certainly all future books to come are also written with that in mind, kind of an area of history that I really like and not enough has been written on.
Yeah, I mean, like I love it. I was reading it in, I was at a conference in Manchester earlier this week, and it was the perfect thing to just sit there in a nice pub, in a pub with a pint, and you can just dip into it. And I was almost scattering through it. Because I'm like, right, recognize the name of that one. Oh, don't know the name of that one. I'm going to read that one first. And then I read that one and go, oh, it's now I'm going to go back and read one of the ones I know a bit more about. And I really like that it's got both an arc and a flow that you can just follow. Or as you say, you can just spot around a bit. I would genuinely describe this, listeners, as if you want something that you can just go, you know what, I'm going to go to the pub for a pint on a warm, sunny day. And I'm going to be there for an exact amount of time because I'm waiting for a thing. And I want to just dip in and read it, get a nice snippet of history. It's absolutely perfect for that. Well, thank you very much for joining us. And
thank you.
Hang around, because we're going to do a bit more for the bonus bits for our subscribers. And listeners, if you want to subscribe, if you are enjoying the podcast, don't forget to like and subscribe. Leave a comment. Do all of those things. Tell a mate. It really helps us out. It spreads the word. But also you can go to untitled-history.com. And you can go there, and if you subscribe on there, you get ad-free versions of the podcast, you get the little chat that me and Alex are about to have now, and you get all the other extra bits that come along with that. We've got merch on there as well. But regular listeners, thank you for listening, and we hope you've enjoyed the podcast.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Untitled History Podcast, a Battle Guide production. If you've enjoyed this episode...
So, Alex, We talked about three kingdoms. Give me another one.
Let's go with Strathclyde. So where is Strathclyde today? Well, if you're asking that in the 8th century, the answer is quite different because it's a kingdom that moves. But nowadays, we consider the centre to be Govan in Glasgow. But if you're in the 8th century, Strathclyde as a name did not exist. It was instead known as Altclut. And the centre was Dumbarton Rock, which is right on the Irish Sea coast at the mouth of the Clyde. And then in about 870, Altclut was besieged by a Viking army composed of Scandinavians, probably Irish, Frisians, and maybe some local Northumbrians. And to besiege anything in the early medieval period, it's quite a...
You have been listening to the Extra Bit on the Untitled History Podcast. If what you have heard there is a thing you want to hear more of, then I'm sorry it faded out, but what you will have to do is back us, and then you can find out more. So don't forget to back us at theuntitled-history.com for more of what you've heard here and more extra episodes in future.